There's a piece of science called fundamental attribution error. We tend to overestimate someone's disposition on decision making and underestimate their situation, when in reality, the bulk of a decision is driven by their situation, not their disposition. And disposition, I would say, with job title and responsibilities versus situation. And so what I would say is, yeah, both of us have come to that moment where the situation drives our response, and we must be fluent enough to do well in each of those given situations.
Welcome to Centricity, the podcast dedicated to helping emerging middle market companies pursue growth and bridge the gap between sales and marketing. In today's episode, our host, Sean Doyle, meets with Tim Reister to discuss the importance of appealing to emotional thinking and how sales and marketing teams can better utilize emotions when selling to executive buyers. If this is your first time listening, we encourage you to subscribe and leave a rating and review. We'd really appreciate it. Now, let's dive in.
Hello, welcome to Centricity, the first episode with the new name. We're excited to have a guest that's a special guest for this prestigious moment in recording history. Centricity is focused on helping executives in the emerging middle market space who are looking for practical, implementable, repeatable insights to break through barriers that are holding back your revenue goals, holding you back from those breakthrough sales and marketing performances, which is why we had Tim Reister join us today. Plus, Tim, I had you join because one of your daughters, apparently a college gymnast and a marketing psych major, has publicly gone out and said she would never work for you. My daughter is known for saying the one summer she worked for Fitzmartin, it was the, quote, worst summer of her life. So we do have that personal connection, I think.
Right, right. The not getting the best dad of the year award is our personal connection. Great.
So why should you listen to Tim? Tim is the chief strategy officer at Corporate Visions. He is also a visionary that leads the research arm B2B Decision Lab, which I'm just geeking out on the behavioral science like Tim does. He's a co-author of four books, including the most recent, The Expansion Sale, four must-win conversations to keep and grow your customers. Most importantly, perhaps, Tim is the father to four daughters. And today, he's going to bring that fatherly wisdom, that science wisdom, to help you be successful. He's helped Wells Fargo, Starbucks, Cisco, Chevron. Certainly, he can help you today. Tim, welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, thanks, Sean. And congratulations on the new name, and I appreciate the opportunity to help you launch it.
Let's go. Well, let's start with what you said right before the show, what you do and how, and that key moment. I'd love for you to start there.
Yeah, it's funny that I like to say that my living is made studying salespeople with their lips moving. And the idea there is that if you are a C-suite member of a company, you've invested your life's work, maybe your life's investment or monies into the business, and you've done everything you can to get it right, and you're hoping a customer says yes. But in between all that is this moment where somebody has to say something smart, articulate value in a way that's meaningful, and persuade a customer to say yes to you. And that's sort of like that praying for a miracle to happen moment. Like, gosh, the product's right. We've got all the services in place. Our NPS scores are awesome. We should have more business. You know, now the magic has to happen. So we always say we occupy the space between you and yes, the customer conversation, and how you can turn that into a codified, repeatable, predictable, like you said, all your favorite words, process, as opposed to a roll of the dice.
Unless something gets sold, it doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah,
that's what people hire us to do.
Well, I argue too that everything that everybody's selling anymore, as much as we think it's different and we love it, the customer can't tell the difference. And so I always like to say the best story told the best will win. And the best sellers, right, they can win regardless of the hand they're dealt too. And we've seen this time and time again. So we've looked at that special moment, a salesperson with their lips moving, and tried to help companies make that more effective.
Oh, that's incredible. So, you know, I'd love for us to spend time today specifically talking about how can B2B salespeople convert those executive level buyers when presenting? Because we've had, listeners, think about this. Think about the deals last year that your sales team came back and said, oh man, I had a meeting with such and such an executive and, you know, I haven't heard back from her, but since then, but you know, I mean, I it was a great meeting. I just don't know what's happening now. Like, what's the value of those deals that just sort of disappeared? What happened there? You know, because 64% of C-level executives are the final decision makers in B2B purchases. So this moment, not to put too much pressure on a moment in time, but this moment in time is really critical. How do you help people identify what to say there, Tim?
Well, and the curse you're talking about is the curse of no decision. And no decision often stops at an executive buyer because they haven't been able to prioritize that. And the challenge that we help salespeople realize is that the reasons they're going to tell you are ultimately lies. What do I mean by that? And now I'm going to get a little geeky on this. Like, the human brain makes decisions in two parts. Part one, they make a decision that they should change. And then number two, they try to justify and validate that decision. And then they actually take the decision. And the problem is that the capacity for language inside of your buyer's brain, and this is true for all buyers, including executives, they have the same brain. The capacity for language lives in the rational, logical part of the brain. So what you're going to do is you're going to ask the customer, why ain't this happening? What do you need? What do you need for me to help you get this over the line? And they're going to give you a lot of rational, logical reasons for what they need and might want to get it over the line. But their decision not to go or, you know, no go is a totally emotional decision. The line you haven't been able to cross, the yes you haven't been able to get, is the yes, I need to change and I need to do it now. Because they keep telling you how you can help them explain it. Once they cross that line, they can't even express to you how to get them there. So we try to study that emotional, intuitive part of everybody's decision-making process and what it takes to move people from no decision and indecision into actually being able to decide as opposed to defer. So that's a sweet spot. And I think that bears more conversation.
It's incredible. First of all, I thought you were going to talk about Broca-Wernicke conflicts, but that would probably be a whole nother conversation. So let's not go there. And if you're really a nerd, you know what I just said. And that's like the conflict between the part of your brain that assembles language and the part of your brain that does the rational and the thinking. So anyway, that another story. What most sellers, in a recent HBR article I was reading, most sellers gave themselves a score of like a B when they said, I was equipped when I met with this executive for the meeting. I was equipped. I was ready. But the HBR also studied the executive buyers of those same accounts, and they gave sellers an average grade of a F. That gap tells me that when a seller's equipped, like he, it's a cliche, I know. But that seller's equipped by thinking they're ready, by knowing their own stuff, right? And the executive buyer must be thinking like that they matter and their problems matter and that's the conflict, because most sellers do know their own stuff, right? So right. When you mention emotional arousal, we would call that a best practice, is to use emotional arousal. I think the thin description of emotional arousal is to make people excited. Mm-hmm. But emotional arousal, is that not really, and you use the word emotional, I'm not trying to lead you. Mm-hmm. I want to hear what your definition of emotional is. We would say emotional arousal should be beyond just getting people excited. Like, oh, that's exciting. No, I want to do that, right? It should show self-interest. Like, I would say a sales rep is prepared if they come to me and say, here's a number, here's a metric in your business, here's where you are. This product and service that I sell can move you from A to B. That's got your interest in mind. I didn't talk about my bells, my whistles, my processes, my gold plating on the wires or any of that, right?
Well, I think that idea that I'm going to help you move from A to B, if you can just contextualize that by saying, and here's what other companies like you are saying, doing, and where they land on the spectrum. Because one thing you know better than your customers, probably, well, I know my products. The other thing you know better is you see more people who look like them than they do. And the one thing they're insanely curious about when they meet with you is, what am I missing? What am I not seeing? And what are others like me doing? Again, I'll say it, because you see more people who look like me than I do. It's an unspoken truth about when they take that meeting with you, they're in their minds going, here's what they're saying. I hope they tell me something I didn't know about a problem or opportunity I didn't know I had based on the fact that they see more people who look like me than I do. Because that adds value. Being able to ask them questions and identify a problem and then tell them back, here's the problem you have, that doesn't add value. You're not a trusted advisor when you do that. You're just a tape recorder. The trusted advisor opens their eyes to the things they might be missing. And it turns out executives, that's the thing they fear most. What am I missing? And that missing is usually compared to what are others like me doing? So the most insanely powerful emotional tool you have is voyeurism. And the way you do that is by creating benchmarks and helping them see what others like them are doing. So you aren't going in and saying, you suck and I can make you better. You're like, hey, let's take a look at others in your category or like you. And here's the things they're struggling with. And this is what that data looks like. Do you have this data in your own company? And how do you compare? So if you're like most, here's where it's at. And you get them talking now. Like, here's how I think I compare to most. Well, we can help you. We can come in and figure out how you compare. But the reality now is that piece of data and then that insight around them in terms of what others like them are looking like and struggling with just invokes that issue, that sort of voyeuristic tendency. And now they're leaning in with that emotional part of the brain going, am I okay? Am I okay enough? Do I need to be better? And how do I compare? And that, like, those are all emotions that are just natural human instincts. And that happens at an emotional and intuitive level, not a rational, logical level. And so, you know, now you know that there's where humans go when they want more information. And you just gotta push those buttons and pull those levers. And it's fully within your power and prerogative, because it's true. Your company does see more people who look like them. Heck, you call on and have conversations with and probably serve more people who look like them than they get to know. Right? They're just myopically, parochially focused on their company. And they lift their head off the desk when you show up at 2 o'clock and they're like, please tell me something I don't know. And preferably tell me about others like me and what they're up to. And so I always joke, let's just start acting that way. Let's act like we know more people who look like them and let's start giving them some of that insight.
Man, you're singing to the choir, Tim. I just had a conversation with a coworker of the 100 emails I get a day. That's an exaggeration, but I'm a marketer. I can exaggerate a little bit. Hyperbole is part of my world. I mean, you get 10, 15 emails a day saying, gosh, Tim, I know how to help you with your business. Let's say that you've got this problem or whatever. I know how to help you. I know how to help you. I know how to, we have this XYZ process, da, 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 da. Delete, 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 delete. Then occasionally, and this is true, I got an email once that said, do you know that a company, a professional services company your size, that you should be spending about 45% of your adjusted gross income on salaries? That's pretty interesting. Like, that's a number that I know. This is about me. And then it went on. So I'm like, okay, I'll read this. And then it went on to say, if you're over that 45%, here's what you might want to look at. And if you're under that 45%, here's probably some problems you're experiencing. Do you want to have a call? Do you want to talk about this more? Man, that's what you just described, Tim. I mean, you gave me a dashboard to look into another world and evaluate whether I had a problem based on data.
Right.
You're singing. And that is not, it sounds like it's a rational tool, but that's actually emotional, because I want to gauge myself. I want to raise your hand if you haven't clicked on the link to see a salary survey. Come on. Everybody does it, right? You want to look out and see what other people are doing and how am I being treated? That's emotional. I'm putting words in your mouth. You're the star here.
No. I mean, that's the whole point, is like everybody wants to say people need data, but I always say it's data wrapped in a story. And so if you can share a piece of data and then give people a hint at why it is the way it is, and then get them to ask themselves, is it that way with me? We call that technique data insight question. It's a very powerful technique. And we've studied this, that the data anchors somebody. Like, whoa, I didn't know. I knew it might have been a problem, but I didn't know it was that big. I didn't know it was that bad. I didn't know it was coming that fast, you know? And now you gave me some insight, because you can express data, but I go, then I shrug my shoulders and I'm like, wow, it sucks for me, sucks for somebody. But now you give me a couple insights as to why that might be and how it looks. And then now you ask me the question, does it look the same way in your organization? Right? So example, 60% of sales cycles end in no decision. Did you realize that number was that big? Okay, maybe you did. But did you realize that the reason that we've been able to uncover is that you're trying to distinguish your product and they don't even know they have a problem? And so what you got to do is help them see that they have a problem big enough to solve before they care about your product. That's called the why change story instead of the why you story. And then the question, so how confident are you that the stories your salespeople are telling push that why change button, or are you landing in that commoditized why us, why you sort of dialogue that causes nobody to think they need to change because you sound all the same? So then data, insight, and then you ask the question. You kind of get them to try it on. You transfer the ownership of this now to the listener, and they can't help now but now start to invest in it a little bit. So DIQ, just a freebie today. Data insight question is a way to just capture attention, introduce an unconsidered need, get that emotional brain working with just enough rational content. Like if there's data, you kind of satisfy both parts of the brain. But yet, you know, you're doing the heavy lifting, the hard work that's required to disrupt somebody's status quo.
Man, mic drop. Let's go.
The Fitzmartin approach to research is simple. Start with data. We use statistical analysis and data visualization to clarify the haze around customer sentiment, behavior, and lifetime value metrics. Our most recent study helped a financial institution understand a group of new customers, identify their ideal customers, and craft a plan to acquire more of those ideal customers. Visit fitzmartin.com/solutions. Again, that's fitzmartin.com/solutions to download a free sales barrier analysis worksheet to find the gaps and barriers in your organization and read for yourself about the values a partnership with Fitzmartin can deliver to you.
So, why now conversations? Tell me one or two things that I need to, what do I need to know about a why now conversation?
Yeah, you know, the why change conversation, that DIQ thing, like telling them something they didn't know in a way that's really meaningful. But now, okay, I should probably consider changing. Why should I do it now? That one is harder because sometimes it's like you amped them all up, but just you hit a wall. And there's a couple things. But one I have to tell you is that even executives appreciate this. We call it current state, future state, story with contrast. And the key is that you have to diagram and articulate and work with them to put the current state on the table. And because in order to get someone to change, they have to believe there's enough contrast between what they're doing today and what you're going to help them do different and better tomorrow. If there's not enough contrast, here's my bumper sticker. Nobody changes if they think they're going to get more or less the same. And so you have to be very clear about the contrast between the current state and the future state. So they go, okay, I see what I'm doing now and maybe why that's not good enough, but I see how different and better it can be because my perception of value lives in contrast. If there's not enough contrast, I'm not going to change because it's too risky to change just to get what I already have. And so you have to draw a clear picture of the current state and the future state. And there's multiple things going on, but the part of the brain that's making this decision just craves contrast before and after. That's why we like before and after photos, right? We can't infer that they know their current state. You have to help them document it in a way that's meaningful so that you can show them the future state. So we call it a current state, future state, business story with contrast. And that includes visuals to help them see what's wrong and what's right. It includes numbers to show them what they're losing and what they can gain. There's a whole lot wrapped up in that story. But the main thing I want to get across here is you need a story with contrast because perception of value lives in that contrast.
There's so much I want to talk about, but I know we're getting ready. You do have to catch a train in a minute. So we have to wrap. But I think there is so much to what you're saying. It's incredible. Centricity, the model that we help clients apply to their businesses and their marketing and sales problems, it points to that looking forward, looking back. And everybody, our science was rooted on the theorem of behavioral change by James Prochazka and Norcross and DiClemente. And they say that 80% of all these people that are moving through your pipeline are looking back. And I would say, I'm often asked, what's the number one mistake I see in marketing and sales? I usually say too much money is spent on the early stage creations of awareness. Way too much money. I'd say the next most common mistake is when you get somebody looking toward making change, we don't spend enough time helping them see the way it was. And that's what you just said. I mean, you're validating me, man. I love this.
Well, that, you know, if that was my sole mission today, mission accomplished. What I would say is, you know, that's the beauty of the science, right? Where it's all rooted in human decision making. This stuff has been studied and restudied for the last 40 years and vetted and proven. B2B Decision Labs, where I work, I always joke that we study this in B2B decision making. Much of the science that's out there for the last 34 years was done on grad students, gamblers, and convicts. And I guess they were captive audiences who'd participate for very little money. But we do it on B2B deciders. We put it into real world tests to see how people react to this or that story, this or that visual, this or that conversation, this or that negotiation, and then package up recommendations like DIQ and contrast based on those findings. So they're rooted in the science of all human decision making. And all we've proven is that B2B decision makers are human. They still need and require and rely on the same decision making design principles as all other humans. And we forget that in B2B sometimes. We start thinking that they're just making rational, logical, business jargony decisions. Right. And it's just not true.
Well, it's a C-suite. It's not a human. It's a C-suite.
That's right. That's right.
All right. Exactly. So Tim, we've spent a couple of weeks reading and listening to your work and reading interviews and looking at your website. Before you go, I got two kind of juicy questions. I can't wait to see how you answer these. So
it's that kind of interview. Is that what you're telling me? Are you going to make me cry? Is that what's going to happen?
I do not have any Oprah techniques in my arsenal. So no crying. You can't cry in baseball. What's that? Tom Hanks, League of Their Own. Imagine you're the executive of this B2B emerging middle market business. You've got a limited amount of resources, and I have yet to find the client that didn't have the limited resources. You've got to impact top-line revenue in your organizations through sales and marketing investments. What's the one thing you would do first?
So I think I'm going to speak a little bit from a timely perspective. I don't know what 2023 is going to bring for everybody, but the move we're hearing and the one I'm leaning into is the disproportionate share of our revenues coming from keeping and growing our existing customers. And having a great understanding of what your cross-sell and upsell opportunities are, leveraging business reviews with your customers if you don't do it in order to plant those seeds and do it in a highly productive way. Job one, you got to make sure that you've covered the white space and you've leveraged those relationships, because the likelihood of winning new business in an entrenched era is even harder than it ever was. The status quo bias has now been like just quadrupled based on economic uncertainty. So job one. Job two, then on the acquisition side, is you need to have a sharp, sharp point of view. Like I said, status quo coupled with economic uncertainty requires you to do some heavy lifting. You need a lot of juice and energy to get somebody to reconsider their current approach. And you need a distinct point of view that causes people to rethink what they're doing. And the problem is most people come in there with traditional discovery techniques, ask the same questions, put up the same logo slide, and there's just nothing there for anybody to reconsider. You're going to have to bring a little uncertainty about their status quo for them to be open to persuasion to change what they're doing.
That's amazing. We literally just got done. The reason I was a little late to this was we were meeting with the CEO and explaining the idea of forced reevaluation. People don't need more awareness. They don't need more awareness. They need to know why. Why do I care? That's much more powerful. I would say as you're vetting advertising agencies and looking at your marketing departments or leaders, you should be asking that question. Don't tell me how you're going to create awareness. Tell me how you're going to make it relevant. What are you going to do? I love this.
Yeah, yeah. How are you going to create a reckoning in the mind of the audience? Yeah, yeah.
What's it? It's great that you sell that thing, but so what? What?
Yeah. Oh, that's a lovely shade of green.
All right, this is your softball, but I think really you're going to be insightful in this. In the last, a few years, What's the most transformative, or maybe it's even better to hear what your customers think, the most transformative thing that you've learned about sales and marketing?
I've always known that psychology of decision making is the main driver. I now know that the situation your customer's in affects their psychology. For example, hey, I'm going to talk to a C-suite financial person. Well, that C-suite financial person who's working with someone else has a different psychology than the C-suite financial person who's working with you, who has yet a different psychology than a C-suite financial person who used to work with you and now works with someone else. So we've been doing work on acquisition being different than retention, being different than expansion, and now even winbacks. We found that a winback is just a slightly different psychology. And so if you really want to aim after, like pick a growth target, acquisition, retention, expansion, and now I'll add winbacks, you have to know how they're coming, the frame of mind they're showing up with, and then make sure your message and your approach fits that. And the fact that I've been able to go for the first 30 years of my career saying it's about behavioral science, and then the last year or two saying, oh my gosh, it's about the situation they're in that drives the behavior, that's what kept this all exciting to me, to create situational fluency in messaging and approaches based on where they're at, not just the motion that you're running.
Tim, I was recently taught the question, would it matter? And what I was doing, my coaching that I was getting from sales was going in and telling Tim, we can do this, we can do this, we can change this, we can buy, we can grow this, we can lower your cost of customer acquisition, we can increase your lifetime value, blah, 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 blah. And I was taught that I didn't ask Tim, if we did that, would it matter? Mm. And I'm reminded of a massive failure of mine when I was a younger man and I had hair, where I'd asked for some egregious amount of money from some executive. And he said no and no and no and no and no. And he finally just said, Sean, I can spend this money and hope for ROI, but we're going to be acquired in the next 3 months. And I'm getting a multiple of X on everything I don't spend. Why would I spend a dollar with you? I was like, well, that changes everything. And that's what you just said, Tim. I mean, that's context mattered. It wasn't that he didn't think I could do what I could do. He thought I could get ROI in marketing. It just didn't matter.
Yeah. You know, if we want to nerd out for 30 more seconds, there's a piece of science called fundamental attribution error. We tend to overestimate someone's disposition on decision-making and underestimate their situation, when in reality, the bulk of a decision is driven by their situation, not their disposition. And disposition, I would say, with job title and responsibilities versus situation. Oh, we're going to get sold in 3 months. I got to take cost out of this business. Oh, that would be good to know, right? So fundamental attribution error. We as humans do it all the time. Somebody cuts us off on the road. We're like, that person's a jerk. The reality is they might have to go to the restroom. They might have somebody's delivering a baby, you know, whatever it is. And so what I would say is, yeah, both of us have come to that moment where the situation drives our response and we must be fluent enough to do well in each of those given situations.
We could talk for another hour, but every listener, especially my mother, is hoping we stop. So I would love to invite you back, Tim, to do a follow-up. There's so many things. I'm really interested right now in this. I'm reading a lot about frictionless buyers' journeys. And is that actually wrong? Should there be friction to create lifetime value? There's so many things about the way people buy and think and how that impacts it. I know we could have another conversation that would help our listeners. So I'd love to invite you back. I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask you to say yes or no now, because that would be bad sales, right? Please consider it.
So what does it mean to me? What does it matter? Yeah.
I don't know, but it would be good for me because I've learned a lot today.
All right. Well, thank I can you, do Tim. It. I love talking and it's been a pleasure. Thanks, Sean.
If somebody wants to get a hold of you and learn more about you, how could they do that?
Yeah, most easily, since my name's not easily spelled, Corporate Visions, plural, all one word, corporatevisions.com or b2bdecisionlabs.com. Sign up for the work, the research, and you can also track me down through there. They'll find me.
And I would assume I could buy the expansion sale on Amazon?
You can. Yep. And a couple more just like them. But I'm not here to shamelessly plug anything. Just spread the milk.
I plugged it, Tim. You didn't plug it. I plugged it.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Listeners to Centricity, we have been excited to bring Tim to the table today, and we hope you got specific value. I know I did. Until next time.
We sure appreciate you listening today. If you would like to get in contact with today's guest or stay in touch with us, visit our show notes. Additionally, to get the latest strategies for the alignment between marketing and sales, visit fitzmartin.com. As a reminder, if you have found value in today's episode, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify, or your favorite podcast directory. Until next time, thanks for listening.